Welcome back to the Act in Context podcast. My name is Tim Gordon.
And my name is Joanne Steinwachs. For those of you who don't know, ACT refers to Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. ACT, pronounced as ACT. So ACT in Context, that's what we're mostly talking about.
Thanks so much, Joanne. And Welcome to our guest. We are so lucky to have my co-author, my very dear friend, my colleague, Jessica Borshak. Welcome, Jessica.
Hey, Jessica. Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, this is really cool. So, Jessica, you and I know each other really well. We've done a lot of really cool work together. Mm-hmm. And we thought it would be a lot of fun to just have you on the podcast to talk about some of the innovative things that you've been doing in ACT, as well as to talk about some of your latest publications and even some of the research that you've done. You and I worked on a psychosocial intervention for like ACT in the neonatal intensive care unit. And so I thought we could just have some fun and talk about all these different novel applications of ACT. And also, I see you as one of the innovators in the ACT world because you're applying ACT in a motivational enhancement way, like you use values in a really profound way. I've seen you give webinars and trainings where you talk about values work and engagement with values in a way that is so, like, for me, I'm like, that is novel. I need to write this down verbatim. Like, I'm using that with my clients. So I would love to let us have a conversation and capture some of that.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Let's do it.
Yeah. And since I don't know either, I mean, I know Tim, but I don't know you, Jessica, I'll be the person who's like, can you expand on that? Cause I don't understand.
Well,
when you guys go into shorthand, when you go into relationship shorthand.
Well, hopefully by the end of this, we'll have our own inside jokes, Joanne.
Yeah. That usually happens. So.
I like that term, by the way, relationship shorthand. Just could you like just tell us a little bit about like where your journey started with ACT? I know that a lot of people are curious about like they go from reading an ACT book or taking an ACT workshop or webinar, and it's sort of this huge world that they've all of a sudden come in contact with. Can you tell us a little bit about like how you just started to immerse yourself in this work and what your journey has been?
Absolutely. So I feel like my journey has been a little bit different than a lot of folks who had learned ACT in the past is that I learned ACT in my graduate program. So my first semester of graduate school, I had a professor, William O'Brien, who is amazing, Bill O'Brien, who in our research class would just kind of sneak in ACT stuff a little bit, trying to
sneak
get everyone.
Act, yeah, like sneak
absolutely.
Acting.
Yeah, yeah. He'd be like, just mention some examples or talk about it. My program is very behavioral based. We had a lot of CBT folks, and I'd never heard of ACT before. And so I was fascinated by this concept, not even because I could see its clinical application, but because it felt very similar to my philosophy of how I lived my life and what I connected with in my life. And so I think it was my first year of graduate school. We went to a one-day training, and I don't even remember her name. I think it was Lori Greco in Ohio. We went to a one-day ACT training with her, and that was awesome. We did some fun stuff. She was making a joke about how a lot of people come to trainings and then end up going home and divorcing their spouses because they were they were connecting to their values and, you know, having different ideas of what a meaningful life meant. And
pause there for a second, Jess, because you said it connected like meaningfully with your personal philosophy. And I get that. I totally relate to that. I think I had the same experience. Mm-hmm. But can you just like go there? Tell us like what that was like for you and what that personal kind of philosophy, like what connected there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had felt that kind of growing up, I'd had kind of this philosophy that if something scared you, that was what you needed to do in your life. In high school, at the end of high school, we had this montage that everyone did. And everyone wrote a quote on their hand. And they took like a, you know, very moody
high school-y.
Exactly.
Very high school. Yeah, I love
that. Photo. And mine was, the only thing to fear is fear itself. And
you can tell the psychologists early on. That's so funny.
Right. And so I really, a lot of times I felt kind of different than my peers. I felt a little bit, I would think in ways in a really different way. I felt kind of a little bit of a disconnect. And for a while, I had spent a lot of my time just trying to conform, trying to fit into the mold of like what normal was and not talk about things that people weren't interested in, but that I was really passionate about. And around the time that I got to grad school, I decided, well, that wasn't really how I wanted to live my life anymore. Not only was it really painful for me because I wasn't connected with what actually mattered to me, my values, though I didn't call them values at the time, mm-hmm. But also I wasn't getting any benefit out of it. Like the thing I was doing that I thought was going to lead to a better life because I could fit in with everyone actually was just causing more distress in my life. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the framework for really understanding why that worked the way it did, but I took some time and really paused and identified kind of, well, what is important to me? Can I embrace all the like nerdy, geeky, quirky, wonderful parts of myself and really make that a part of my life? And then like immediately I met ACT and my mind kind of went, oh, like this makes sense. And I even all throughout graduate school, I had sat down and written out, made a little kind of art thing and had a heart in it and wrote out all of my top values. And I stuck it on my fridge. And I used that kind of as my guiding force. I added some words over the years. I redid it after a couple of years when some things changed in my life. But it was a perfect melding and blending of what I had been experiencing kind of up to that point and some of the realizations I had already begun to make. And then ACT just gave me a framework for being able to understand what was happening and then share that with other people.
That's really cool. Wow. That's like the perfect kind of ACT trajectory, you know? Right. You didn't have to unlearn a whole bunch of crap. You didn't have to go through misery of trying to do things that don't work.
Yep.
That's wonderful. So cool. I hope this is more of what happens for the next generation of ACT people.
Yes. And I think it does. I know definitely from my school, we have my graduate program, we have a lot of ACT people coming out, a couple of fat people, but a lot of ACT folks who are coming out because of Bill O'Brien.
For people who don't understand, don't know what FAP is, it means a couple of things. Yeah. But what we're referring to, what we are referring to is functional analytic psychotherapy, which is a co-traveler with ACT and DBT.
Don't Google what is FAP.
No.
Now they're going to do it. Jessica, they're going to do it for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm fascinated about this. So I'm going to pause here for a second. Mm-hmm. I hope this is cool how informal we are with this conversation.
Totally.
But like when I was in grad school, our training very much was not in any radical behavioral approaches. I remember I gave a seminar presentation. I worked my butt off. Like I poured my heart into this presentation. I was so enthusiastic about it. And I had picked out some what I thought were really cool readings for the class. And I had really funky slides and functional assessment descriptions and all kinds of fun
soundtrack and, you know,
right?
Knowing you, right?
And I did some cool experiential exercises. And so I end the seminar and I'm expecting like, you know, my classmates are going to be really engaged in this and they're going to have lots of questions and want to talk about things. And it was crickets. Like nobody said a word. And my prof is looking at me just like very supportive, like, you did a good job, sweetie.
That was nice.
A little pat on the head.
Yeah.
A for effort.
And she says this to the class because nobody's saying anything. And so she's seated closest to me. And so she's looking back at the class. It's a small, right? It's a graduate seminar class. And she's looking back and she says, if you have any questions about this, I suggest that you ask him now because you will never meet someone for the rest of your career that will have an interest in this. I mean, she's sweet as pie, lovely, and so supportive, right? And the class was just like, oh, yeah, no, that makes sense, because this is pretty whack. So,
and then you went back to her now and you were like, ha.
How's
and
this
award
winning?
If she listens to this
book?
Webinar, she's going to go, ah.
I mean, no,
she was truly, I didn't experience it as critical. I thought she was really just trying to help. And it's so funny because I wonder, like, when Joanne and I, like, Joanne was trained in psychoanalysis. That's right. Right, Joanne?
Yeah.
And
sorry, I was.
Yeah.
And great. Actually, I'm not going to apologize. There's enormous value in that tradition.
Yeah. And I had came from a background in social work that was very similar, lots of psychoanalytic, psychodynamic work. So I'm always curious, like, what do people from the other side, like Jessica, what do you think of us who have not come from a behavioral background, who come from this more like psychoanalytic background and who then transition into ACT and start, you know, maybe learn it as a technology and then start getting into the behavioral science.
Mm-hmm. I actually think it's wonderful. I feel that I'm at a huge disadvantage actually in a lot of situations. Like Tim, I've been to your trainings before, and because you've had training in so many different modalities, it gives you the opportunity to describe how you got to where you are. But what it also means is that when other people are interested and they're asking questions, you can take what their framework is that they're already coming in with and be able to speak to them in a way that helps them bridge the gap between what they know and where you want to be. And you have an idea of, well, what part of ACT are they going to connect with most? Oh, or what language can I use that they can understand what I'm saying without me feeling like I'm saying, you have to get rid of all that stuff that you learned before and take this over, right? Without making it feel like a cult, to be honest. And it also challenges me is that I will see folks who have gone maybe their whole careers and maybe they're really strong CBT folks, cognitive behavioral therapy, maybe they're more psychoanalytic or something else entirely. And they're willing to open their minds to something radical, something totally different. And there's a lot of strength in that. I don't know if, 20, 30 years from now, if I'll be that open to whatever new innovative thing comes around. I hope so. I hope I still have that thirst for learning. But because I started off with ACT and it connected with me so deeply, it's had a lot of benefits, but it's also come with some shortcomings.
Yeah. I think that's completely valid. Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you for that observation. That was the very sweet for me to hear. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, and it's
I want to just say one thing. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Jessica.
I was just going to say it's the challenge that new folks face now is because they are coming in and ACT is the first thing that they learn. And it is important to put yourself out there and learn about other disciplines with an open mind rather than just, oh, that's nonsense. ACT is the best.
Yeah. I've been in the field a lot longer than both of you. Mm-hmm. You may not notice that, but
probably
I have.
Longer than both of us combined, actually.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is
what
cool.
What did you just say? I think I heard something that you didn't say.
Oh no! I was saying that you've been in the field longer than Jessica and myself combined.
Not older than both of us combined.
No, I am older than both of you.
But in the field.
Back to this point. Off on a tangent.
Sorry. No, I know that you've been a social worker for a long time, Joanne.
1985.
Yeah.
Right.
Like,
okay.
If you had have killed social work, you would be out of jail by now.
Okay. To the point, I wrote an article, I can't remember a chapter somewhere, and I had to do a lot of research about social work training. And until I got out of grad school, I probably wasn't a social worker till 1990. I got out of graduate school in 1990-ish. And 10 years before that, behavioral training was a core course in all social work schools.
Wow.
Isn't that sad and crazy?
Yes.
Yeah. It was like the courses that we took because it made so much sense for social work.
Yeah.
You know, so, learning theory, behavior. I mean, and it just CBT just blew it right out of the water. Uh-huh. And I think part of that has to do with how difficult the language is certainly in behaviorism, but the conceptual shift that you have to take to see the world from this perspective is, I think, really hard for people. And I see a lot of people getting kind of wonky and kind of challenged by that.
Mm-hmm. It was very challenging for me when I was first diving deeper into ACT, right?
Well, just diving deeper into ACT, but you know, I remember when I went to my first training, I emailed Steve Hayes, who is one of the developers of ACT, and I said, I need some preparation. What should I read? And he said, well, read Catania. Okay, so Catania is a textbook for, you probably read Catania, right, Jessica? Yeah. Right?
I'm not sure if I did.
Oh,
I might have.
Yeah, it's one of these really like super geeky, like the kind of book that you understand every word in the sentence, but you have no idea what the sentence means. And that was the level that he was at. That was his basic fundamental level. And I was so far behind that, you know? I had no conception. So I had to do an incredible amount of learning on my own to understand basic concepts. Like negative reinforcement is not being punished.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
That's not what it is. To understand just reinforcement.
Or even the word consequences. Consequences doesn't mean bad stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the outcome of something.
Right.
The funny thing is, in grad school now, we are reading Steve Hayes' papers, and then all of us as a group sitting there and trying to understand what all the individual words mean put together.
Totally.
Right. So then I also read the first RFT book. I don't know if you guys have read that book. Talk about nosebleed reading. You know, so I read Catania, and I thought, okay, well, I need another book. And I read RFT, and I was like, again.
Yeah.
This is in English. I speak English. I have no idea. And I just realized that I didn't know something that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And people were having conversations in the community, and they would start, you know, da 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 da, and I would go da da, and they wouldn't go there. They'd go somewhere else.
Yes.
Completely somewhere else. And I did not know how they made those connections. So it's a very powerful shift, I think. So one of the things I'm saying to you, Jessica, is I don't think you have to do that shift, but I think a lot of people in our community to do ACT, I think, effectively, do need to understand behaviorism and learning theory on a very deep level. And it's hard. It's really, really hard.
And there's also something a bit confusing about that, because people refer to it as like the behavioral science stuff. They refer to it, and you'll see this, as like basic science, right?
It is, yeah.
And so that's confusing to me, because when I think of basic science, I'm thinking of like, you know,
physics
science in high school. Yep. You got it. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it is. Once you understand principles like this, you can actually see how this is, these principles actually are everywhere. They explain, you can explain and predict with these principles almost everything. I think everything that humans do, in my opinion. In my opinion, with relational frame theory. We're so geeking out here. Is this where you guys want to go?
So I wanted to kind of maybe bring it back to I guess, training clinicians, is that one of the difficulties with learning all of this is it really means you have to look at your own behavior and go, oh, there are some things that I'm doing that aren't taking me to my best life. Mm-hmm. And you need to go through that process to understand the process, right? Applying it to yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's really difficult work. And yet it's the work that we ask our clients to do all the time, to go to a really difficult place and really look hard at what they're experiencing. And I think sometimes we take it for granted, all the difficult stuff that we're asking folks to do. And learning this process, learning ACT, means that we have to go through that process as well in order to really understand the approach to ACT, not just do this exercise or do this skill, but have this framework in mind. And that's tough work.
Mm-hmm. I think just the flip of pain isn't the issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the purpose of a human life is not to avoid and get rid of pain. Mm-hmm. Just that flip. Yeah. Is world-altering, I think, for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Or the concept that this idea that everyone is happy all the time and that that's the norm is completely ridiculous. Yeah. Happiness is a fleeting emotion just like every other emotion. Within this podcast, we'll probably experience dozens of emotions and then dozens of combinations of emotions. And yet it's...
I have a funny story about that. I have a funny story about that. I was working with a woman years ago who had, you know, fairly complex trauma. Mm-hmm. We were talking about emotions. And I said, you know, emotions are kind of like smoothies. You know, they're kind of blended together. And she said, that's awful. That's terrible. I can't do that.
Yeah, no.
And now we laugh about it, you know. Mm-hmm. What kind of smoothie do you have? I have a blueberry liver smoothie today.
Ooh, blueberry liver.
Right? Mm-hmm. But that quality of that, which I think Buddhism speaks to a lot, the fluidity and the complexity and the movement constantly of our personal events, our private events are always going on. Anyway, off on a tangent, coming back.
No, I think it's totally relevant. I love it.
Yeah. So, I think there's a lot of shifting, a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of worldview, like how the world is, right? That actually, when you enter into this community and enter into this work, it really does powerfully shift, you know? Yes. And I think for me, recognizing that ACT was not something I did to someone in therapy. It's something I do with someone. I actually say it a lot, you know, I step into the ACT world. Well, I kind of live there, but I, you know, I come into that ACT stance and I invite my clients and my students and my trainees to join me, you know, and I don't get to control whether or not they come, but I do get to have impact on whether or not I stay in that stance, you know, and I think that's a very different way to consider doing clinical work. Don't you guys?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, yeah. And so my background is in behavioral medicine, right? So I work, my research was all about obesity, diabetes management, increasing physical activity. I work with people going with, dealing with chronic pain or chronic medical conditions. And when we think of like behavioral training, we think of a doctor sitting across from someone and saying, exercise more and eat better, eat your vegetables. Right. And when we think about how we want to shift people to live a better life, it's not enough to just tell people what to do. I mean, if someone told me what to do, I would, depending on who they are, give them a not so nice response or just ignore them completely. Mm-hmm. And research shows that information doesn't actually change people's behaviors. It rarely even changes people's attitudes. And so we're taking this behavioral approach when we're really focusing on how people live their lives, but we're doing it in a way that connects with a lot of these internal processes, right? It connects with, well, what's important to you? And can we look at our behaviors in terms of how we get there? And then instead of only looking at external barriers, like, be honest, our world is not set up for people to thrive, particularly in the health realm. And can we look also at the thoughts and feelings and histories of trying to do something and not being successful over and over again, that defeated stance? And can we look at that stuff? And instead of trying to push it away or convince ourselves that, oh, this time is going to be different and, oh, I just need to have the right tool or trick, but really take a step back and say, no, it's about bringing all of that pain with you. It's about feeling that craving or noticing that discomfort when you look at yourself in the mirror and holding that and loving that part of yourself and then using all these behavioral techniques to help you move forward in your direction. But it's really more about how we address what I would consider maybe barriers or things that get in the way of that moving forward. And it's a really important piece when we talk about the behavioral fields of, you know, how we get people to do stuff. Mm-hmm.
Do you find, Jessica, that one of the pieces you have to do or have to help people with is accepting the body they have? Because sometimes people, when they're talking about changing their physicality and their body, they have an idea about what it should be. And, you know, for whatever reason, it's not going to be that. You can have the best body you can have, but you're probably not going to look like a supermodel.
Absolutely.
And if that's the image of success, right, I think that people are going to fail, of course. But my experience is that letting go of that idealized goal is a very difficult thing to do. Very painful.
I think it comes back a lot of times to values because, so we all want to look great. We all want our partners to find us attractive. We all, you know, love to put on an outfit, and whether it's confidence or strength or attractiveness, we just want to have that kind of feeling. Like that feels awesome.
Yeah. Right?
And yet that's not going to sustain us when it's been a really stressful day and all I want is pizza. That's not going to help us get to our dreams. And really at the end of the day, it doesn't change our lives. And I think that is a really important point to explain to people, is that you getting to this body that you want changes your life in no way, except that you need to get your clothes tailored. I used to work in a bariatric clinic, so I worked with folks pre and post surgery who would get bariatric surgery. And we did all of this preparation before, and people would be really frustrated. And it was because they had this idea that, well, once I lose the weight, my life will totally change. My relationships will get better. My boss won't be a jerk to me anymore. You know, my kids will respect me. And they lose all this weight and realize, nope, the only thing that changed is what I look like. And so trying to, one, set expectations. I worked with a lot of veterans, and we had to have conversations that you're not going to get back to your 18-year-old body in boot camp. No one is. That's just not the same body that you have anymore. You could be really fit. You can be strong. You could live a long, healthy life and get to run around with your grandkids. But you're not going to be 18 years old again.
And 2% body fat. That's not going to happen again.
Yeah. And that's what, you just don't have the time to exercise that much.
Well, it's not physically possible either.
And your body,
as we age, it's not possible. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so my focus a lot of times, which is funny in like a weight loss clinic, is not weight loss. It's on what does this weight loss afford you? Or what does this strength afford you? Because if you want to lose weight, just stop eating food.
Yeah.
But you can go on a cookie diet and eat 3 cookies a day and drop a ton of weight.
Yeah.
But you're going to gain it back really quickly. You're going to be miserable, and it's not going to change your life in any way. And so really, and people are really resistant to this, right? You'll see them at first say, oh, well, my health. Oh, well, I want to be there for my kids. But it's said in almost this detached kind of way, like these are the answers I'm supposed to give. And so I really slow down and spend a lot of time helping them really picture what are the consequences, what are the outcomes of not changing anything in your life and moving forward, and what does making changes, and we identify specific changes, not weight loss or not eating healthy or exercising more. We identify like specific things that you do. That's the more kind of behavioral stuff coming in. But then what actually changes in your life? And you'll see people, I've had clients tell me, you know, if we go out 10 years of what their life will be like, and they'll look me in the eye and they'll say, I'll be dead.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll pause with, what are you feeling right now? Like, you just told me if you don't make these changes, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And we'll even describe, well, what will your life look like your world look like when you're no longer there? And it's not for the purpose that I want to make the folks I'm working with feel bad.
Of course.
But we don't make people like cry.
Using a burst of control.
Just for, it's like, you know, I just like making people cry. But we do it because there are so many things in our life that are going to be immediate and pleasurable and going to draw you off that path. right? Oh, I'm tired today. I'm just going to curl up and watch some Netflix. Mm-hmm. Oh, I really want that pizza. I deserve it. I'm stressed out. Mm-hmm. And doing that every once in a while is totally fine. I ate pizza yesterday. But if we can connect with these long-term consequences and benefits, then, and what really matters when we distill it all down, then they have a much higher success of actually implementing all of these behaviors that we know that works. Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that your use of death is, I think, really mm-hmm. helpful and thoughtful. I mean, you know, Buddhism has been doing this for, you know, thousands of years. There's a really cool Zen saying that goes, given that the only certainty is death and the time of my death is uncertain, what matters to do right now?
I love that.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
That quality of like, you know, we're not immortal. There's not time. There's not plenty of time. And I think when you think about it, like when you see people who are approaching death, values start sorting out really, really quickly. I don't have time for this crap, you know, is something I hear people who are really close to death say. I don't have time for that.
Mm-hmm. And in the obesity realm, what comes up as worse than death?
Yeah.
Being alive, but not
completely non-functional.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. They'll describe, well, I'm stuck in a hospital bed. I'm stuck in a couch because I can't get up and it hurts to move. Mm-hmm. And I'm existing, but I'm watching life pass.
Yeah, that's
by.
A very dark place to be. Yeah.
It's scary. You know, I've had clients who, for example, clients with MS who are worried mm-hmm. about losing functioning and being kind of like locked inside their body, like that.
Which is possible, possible.
Which is a potential possibility, mm-hmm. right? Or folks who are, who have gained a lot of weight and like their knees are deteriorating, but no one will give them knee replacement surgery unless they lose weight, mm-hmm. Because the risk of complications during surgery, the risk of recovery, infections is high, as well as mm-hmm. you're just putting so much extra weight on the joint, it's mm-hmm. gonna be hurt again. Mm-hmm. And when we can really connect, right, through death, through this kind of living death, which is how I think about it, mm-hmm. This existence, mm-hmm. we can really put at the forefront, like, what is coming down the pipeline. Mm-hmm. And only then can we begin to move forward. So oftentimes my clients will get really frustrated with me or will be very confused because mm-hmm. they're used to someone coming in and going, okay, you need to start, you know, eating more vegetables. You're going to put your shoes by the
front. Golly, we're going to get this going. You know?
Put your shoes by the front door. And we're making all of these changes that scientifically are valid and that are helpful, but they're completely useless if we don't first address the why this matters. Because we only do things that are reinforcing in our lives. And so we want to bring into the forefront, well, what is that outcome, that consequence that we really want that's so far in the future that it's hard for us to even see?
I want to ask your opinion on something, Jessica. When I worked with people who have these kinds of issues, but let's just use being overweight. Mm-hmm. So there's two different ways you can go. You can not want to be fat. I don't want to be a fat, disgusting pig.
Yeah.
Right? So as you lose weight, you become less fat and disgusting. Mm-hmm. So your motivation to lose weight gets lower as you lose weight.
Yeah.
But I want to be able to do more things that matter to me physically. As you lose weight, your motivation gets stronger mm-hmm. because you can do more of those things. And I think that's kind of what we've been talking about. Like, I don't want to be a fat pig, put your shoes by the front door versus there's a reason for me to put my shoes by the front door. There's a meaningful place I go. That's not just about the number on the scale. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. And right. Oftentimes there's even measures that look at whether someone is and it's like a reward versus avoidance, right? So are you motivated by wanting to avoid certain consequences, mm-hmm. Whether it's, oh, I'm fat or I'm unattractive, or it's, you know, everyone in my family has diabetes and I want to avoid that, or it's, I want to live a long life and play with my kids and what the rewards are.
Right.
But we can use And for a while, behavioral medicine focused on those two and had a different approach based on those two things. But you're absolutely right. When you start seeing some changes, what happens with the folks who are trying to avoid something is that motivation goes away. It's the reason why folks have heart attacks, for example, a cardiac event, and they're scared. And the doctor's like, you almost died, or maybe your heart did stop and they had to, you know, resuscitate you. And afterwards, it's like their whole life changes. They're annoying to be around because all they talk about is, you know, their green smoothies and, you know, exercising. But the further they get away from that scary consequence, the less intense that fear is, they go back to how they were. And so the approach that I take is, whether you're trying to avoid a negative consequence, like getting diabetes or really having a disgust or a distaste for what you look like, or you're moving towards a reward, I use both of those to circle back to, and why does that matter? Right? So if you hate the way that you look, or you don't like the, you know, you think you're disgusting or ugly or whatever kind of mean things you say to yourself, well, can we go back and say, well, what would change in your life if that wasn't there? Because we all know that that voice in your head is not just going to go away, right? There's this idea that people lose weight, but you'll hear, like, up here in my head, I'm still that overweight or obese person. Right. And so what do you believe losing weight and changing what you look like will afford you in life? And can we have a really frank talk about whether what you think the outcome is going to be is actually the outcome? Because I've worked with lots of people, and folks lose weight and they feel better about themselves, but unless they're doing other work, simply changing the way their body looks is not going to change this long history of your mind telling you that you're fat and stupid and ugly and disgusting and no one values you or thinks you're interesting.
Can I ask you a question? Of course I can. just from seeing you, I'm pretty sure that your weight is within normal range. You're not grossly obese or anything like that. So when you're interacting with someone who has struggled with their weight since they were like four, and you're saying all of this stuff to them, do you ever get from them like, you have no idea what I'm talking, you know, what are you talking about? You have never addressed, this is not something you deal with.
Absolutely.
And so how do you, as an therapist, engage around valuing when from the client's point of view, you are not on the same planet? Yeah. How do you do that? How do you speak to that with people?
Yeah. So I will definitely get the camp that says, oh, you're a normal, healthy weight. I want to learn from you because you're clearly doing something correctly.
Or you genetically were gifted.
Yeah. Or you're just lucky or something like that. The folks who will say, like, you don't know what I've been through. Mm-hmm. And so one of my first responses is, how do you know that? How do you know that I wasn't overweight as a child and didn't struggle? And I don't tell them whether I was or not.
Yeah.
But what really comes across is, one, I do use my own examples. Just because someone looks like they're healthy weight doesn't mean that they're healthy. I know a lot of people who look super fit and are doing really unhealthy things to their bodies.
Yeah.
Really obsessive exercise habits or really restrictive food to the point that it's dangerous. And so sometimes it's showing some vulnerability to say, just because I don't look the way that you do doesn't mean that I don't have my own struggles.
So this is, I think, a really important piece for clinicians of disclosure in a way that's useful and not stepping over the line. Yeah. So I wonder if you would give like a precise example, maybe something that a client said and then you said and how you figured out, like, this is something that I can share with this client that's going to help us move towards valuing together.
Absolutely. So I've already on this podcast mentioned pizza multiple times. While I have never been overweight, I have been at a place, my some self-disclosure here, my family has a history of high cholesterol and things like that. And I'd had kind of a wake-up call when I was in my early 20s and I'd gotten blood work done that while I looked healthy, I wasn't necessarily super healthy on the inside. Yeah. And so I've struggled with trying to make some dietary changes in my life. And so I will talk to a client. So a client might come to me and say, you know, I'm feeling really stressed or I'm feeling these cravings, and I will give my own examples. Right. Mm-hmm. I might be able to restrict my food to a certain extent so that I maintain a certain amount of weight, or I exercise to kind of offset some excess calories, mm-hmm. but I'm still facing some of the same struggles that they are. So I'll mm-hmm. use an example of like a pizza, and mm-hmm. I'll say like, I love pizza. I'm not a sweet tooth person. I'm a salty person. And I was at a point once where I would eat a whole medium pizza by myself a couple times a week. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that I was gaining a ton of weight, but it was that I noticed I just felt groggy. My face hurt. It led me to feel more down, but I would get in this space where I would say, well, I deserve this. I've had a stressful day and I deserve to eat this pizza. Mm-hmm. And so I would talk with them about, you know, it wasn't necessarily about the eating pizza. It was about everything else that was leading up to it. It was about mm-hmm. this thought, I deserve this. Mm-hmm. And so when I made the commitment to make a change, it wasn't that I'm never going to eat pizza again. But I kind of thought in my mind, well, when I eat pizza, I want to actually enjoy it, because right now I'm not even enjoying it, because it's almost like this punishment. I eat it. It's delicious. I eat it so quickly. I don't even taste it. And then I feel terrible afterwards. And I'm like, have you ever had that experience? And they're like, oh yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. I think almost anyone can relate to that example. Oh, yeah. And so I said, I had to pause and decide what was leading up to this behavior. And so I made some changes in my life to help better manage stress. Right, to help better organize what my life looked like. And I also was able to pause and be able to recognize when this I deserve something thought came out. What was going on in that moment?
Right. I'm curious about something here. When you do that with a client, it seems to me that probably what you do is you don't go into it in a sort of thinking, cognitive kind of way. You drop into it in that very emotional, yeah. visceral kind of way. And you're speaking from that place. You're not going, let me tell you about a time that I did blah, blah, blah. Yeah. There's a real like physical, like you can probably hear it in your voice, that sense of emotional connection to that event. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. If the one, this is a real actual thing that I struggle with. I have a rule where I don't lie to my clients. Mm-hmm. I might not tell them something. I might not answer a question that they have. Mm-hmm. But I don't, as a rule, lie to my clients. So if I'm sharing an example, it is real. And by being consistent, it means that they can trust the things that I say. Mm-hmm. But also, yeah, if I'm not willing to bring my struggle into the room for the purpose of helping them, right? Not just for the purpose of mm-hmm. sharing things, in a way that really identifies what that struggle was for me. Well, one, they're going to dismiss it very easily and just say, oh, this is just a little, you know, a little blurb that she uses. Oh, that's mm-hmm. cute. The doctor has a little,
her pizza blurb, right?
Exactly. Totally. Oh, her little pizza story that she uses, soundbite. You know, with us.
Which textbook did you read that in? Yeah,
exactly. Right. Yeah. Like, oh, that's cute. But if we can bring that emotion and show that real experience, and by describing in a way that actually reflects what my
your own internal experience of it.
Absolutely.
You're not telling them this is your experience. You're saying this is my experience of that. Is yours like that?
Absolutely.
And which is, I think, a very different way to self-disclose than, you know, well, when I was 14, you know, this is what happened to me. Mm-hmm. You know, you got it bad. Let me tell you.
And even in that process, I'm training them to understand all of these contextual factors, right? All the stuff that's going on. It's not just about the behavior of me eating pizza. It's all of the things. Eating pizza is the outcome.
Right.
It's all of the things that lead up to it.
And it's the topography of it. Yeah.
Exactly. And so what my hope is one, they hear the emotion of it. And so they trust what I have to say. They feel that we're on the same page.
Right.
Because I, even though I don't have the same experiences that they do, I have a flavor for it, a taste for it. And so I can actually understand what they're going through.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about it in a way that one isn't saying, and then I just got over it, or I just sucked it up and refused to ever eat pizza again. And helped them to think about more than just this isolated behavior, but what is the environment, both in the world and in myself.
Sure. Do you find when you have this conversation with people and it's, for want of a better word, successful, you kind of break through that negative specialness that people often carry around what they're struggling with? You don't understand. Nobody understands it. You know, and so when you can actually finish their sentences, they're talking about their internal experience. I think sometimes people get the sense of, I'm not alone. I'm not out in the weird, you know, wilderness of humanness. This is something that I can share with another human being. And there's something really transformative and powerful about that, especially when people have been caught up in that narrative that they're alone, they're different, no one can get it.
Absolutely.
They're freaks. I mean, I hear people talk about being freaks a lot.
And if I look so different than they do, and I'm experiencing this, then
I really liked your comment about how do you know?
Yeah.
How do you know? You're making up a story about me. You have no idea. I love that. That was really cool. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's why I love group work, especially for things that people are experiencing that they feel very alone in. Statistically, it's very likely that they have other people in their lives who are overweight or obese. There's been a lot of studies that kind of show almost as though this behavior, this collection of behaviors of being overweight is something that other people who are around you kind of pick up. It kind of reinforces this big environment. But if someone is dealing with something where they feel very alone, or maybe they're willing to make a change, but everyone else isn't, and they're kind of very dismissive, doing group work is amazing because I can share my experiences, but I'm not dealing with the bias of carrying around extra weight.
Right. You're not sitting, you don't look the way they do.
Exactly.
Right? Exactly. But if you're sitting in a room full of people who look the way you do and struggle with that.
And it's a beautiful normalizing experience. I mean, two-thirds of Americans, and I believe it's the same statistics for Canadians, are overweight or obese. So normal is actually being overweight or obese, but it's not the socially approved way of looking. And for those of you who are listening, I'm making air quotes to mock the socially approved concept. And so doing that group work really helps to bring down, oh, this is just my problem. Or like clients will tell me, well, yeah, but I have a family history of this thing and they have, you know, I have knee problems, so I can't exercise. And I'll just tell them, yeah, that sucks. It's going to be harder for you. I'm not going to sugarcoat that or pretend that their struggles aren't real. Like, it is going to be harder for you than someone else who is more able-bodied. It is going to be harder than you, harder for you because you don't have someone in your life who supports you. You have someone in your life who's actually actively sabotaging what your efforts are. And so that's going to be harder than someone who has a partner who is trying to make these changes with you. Like, yeah, that sucks. And your options are still to try this or not try it. So can we acknowledge that? Can we lay it all on the table and say, like, that hurts, that sucks. You're frustrated. I'm frustrated. I get that.
Do you think also when you acknowledge that some people's context is a lot less supportive and maybe even more toxic than other people's context, for the folk that are in that difficult, more difficult context, their improvements need to be acknowledged because they're up against a much bigger pressure to not change. Does that make sense? So you kind of have to contextualize it with your brother bringing five pizzas home every night, right? And you chose to eat one slice and then have a salad.
Yeah.
That's crazy, amazing that you did that. Or you thought about having one slice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, crazy amazing. Wow.
And it happens both ways. So sometimes I have to stop myself and recognize the progress that they have made. Cause sometimes I'm like really excited for them and I'm like, come on, we can do this. We can do this. And I'm trying to push them faster than is going to be sustainable. And so sometimes I have to check myself and say, well, like they are making progress. This is the pace that they need to go at. My goal is not, you know, how many times they eat pizza in a month. It's how many times they eat pizza in their life. And I don't mean to be like vilifying pizza, but a lot of times clients will come in and they'll be very ashamed of their progress, yeah. right? Of like, oh, but I thought about it, but I still ate all of the pizza.
Yeah.
And I, you might be able to tell, but I'm a very animated person. And so I will be like, are you kidding me? That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's a real, I'm being real and genuine, right? Yeah. If I think that they're slacking off or they're making up excuses for things, or I think that they could be in a different position, we will have that conversation. But the vast majority of the time, I am so proud of the things that my clients do.
Oh yeah. It's extraordinary. It's stunning. Yeah.
And we'll go back to that context. Like, are you kidding? The fact that even though, you know, your spouse and you asked them not to, came home and brought home all those donuts and frozen foods and all of this kind of stuff, that you had a conversation with them about it. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. I can't, like, don't you see that? Like, that's incredible. You would have mm-hmm. never done that a month ago. And so maybe that conversation didn't go well this time. And you and I can talk, we can role play and talk about how to improve that conversation. But like, you're making changes in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely. So a lot of times people put down their progress. And one of the things I also come back to, so I'm big on this concept in ACT, which is present moment awareness, which essentially noticing. And clients will sometimes get frustrated. They want to jump ahead to the doing. But I will explain to them that if we don't have an awareness of everything that's going on that's leading to where you are right now, and I don't mean like childhood histories and stuff like that, but I mean the urges that show up, the environmental context, the people in your life, the feelings or memories that you have. If we don't have an awareness of what's showing up that's leading to some of these problematic behaviors that you have, then we have no hope in hell in changing them.
Yeah.
How are we going to change something that we can't see?
Right.
And so we are exactly where we need to be. If we jump ahead and try to make changes, you are going to fail. Not because you're a failure, because you didn't try hard enough, but because you've moved the first step, which is just noticing what's going on so that then you can make a different choice when that stuff shows up.
Right.
And that sometimes can be a really difficult, kind of frustrating concept for clients to get, because it's the outcome of it isn't, the benefits of it aren't as immediate.
So I think I've told you this anecdote, Tim, maybe not. And I want to hear your thoughts on this, Jessica. So I was talking about this with a client some years ago, and she gave me this beautiful, beautiful metaphor. And she said, so Joanna, my life, it rains a lot. And I'm like, oh yeah, it kind of does rain a lot. She says, yeah, it rains shit. I said, yes, in your life, it rains shit. You're right. And she says, some days I wake up and it's just a light sprinkling of shit outside my door. I said, true. And she said, and some days I wake up and it is a shit typhoon. And I said, you're right. And she said, this is the beautiful part. She said, on the days that it's a shit typhoon, if I can open the door and lean in the direction that matters to me, that's a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, absolutely. So that's what we're talking about, is that contextualizing of what success really looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And sometimes people are facing a shit typhoon. For those people who don't like bad language, I apologize.
I have kind of a potty mouth, but this is how our clients speak, right? Yeah. I mean, like, this is real talk. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that I really like how you're talking about look out, look around you. Are you in a shit typhoon? Because maybe you really are, you know, and that taking one last bite of that donut was big and huge.
I struggle with that. I struggle even though I know that I should listen to my body and stop eating when I'm full. Yeah. I still have this, like, you know, the clean plate club that I need to eat all of the food or else I'm wasting it. And absolutely, there are some days when we're going to be on our A game because, right, it's just a sprinkle outside. And there are some days where getting out of bed and putting on our clothes and even just thinking about
getting into the alphabet at all, you know, not even A. Right?
Noticing stuff is incredible. And if we can have that awareness of that progress looks a little bit different on different days, depending on what's going on, then it makes it easier, one, to do that. But it also makes it easier for us to get up the next day and try something new because we are acknowledging that, you know, this is where life is right now. And I am doing my best to meet it where it's at.
There's something that's that's beautiful. There's something that's occurring to me. Like even just in the ways that, because I've been listening very closely to how each of you have been describing these kind of experiences of doing this work. And what stands out to me is I love this concept of like, it's like, there's difficult stuff that shows up in a client's life and that's separate from who the client is. And then there's this client. And sometimes those things can be really like close together, like happening in this almost magnetic kind of way. And the use of language that both of you are using, the way that you describe this, even Jessica, like your description of like just using present moment work, the metaphor that occurs to me is it's like you're just sliding like a crowbar between that content and the client, and you're just working it back and forth. And I love how each of you describe this behavior of just adding flexibility into wherever you can, just creating a little bit of distance between the client and that stuff. Like that is what occurs to me as being what all of this acceptance and mindfulness stuff is about. Like if we were to distill it down, the two of you have been beautifully discussing like just psychological flexibility, like taking on this position of being here now, this acceptance, like it seems so practical to me. I just wanted to point that out. Especially if our listeners are kind of picking up on, you know, the kind of the this theme like I am in what you're saying.
Cool. I appreciate that, Tim. One of the metaphors I use to kind of get at that with clients is, is a tornado. And obviously, if you live in a place where tornadoes are devastating, maybe it's not the most appropriate metaphor, but I've never lived in those regions. But I like to think of it as the difference between standing in the middle of a tornado and standing just outside of it. If you're in the middle of a tornado, you are consumed by everything that's flying around you. You can't see anything else. You can't see a way out. It's just whipping by you and it's overwhelming you. But if you can just take a step back just outside of the tornado, you're still feeling the whip of it. It's not going away. You're still feeling the debris hitting your face and the wind.
It's still a tornado.
It's still a tornado, but you can see the whole landscape. Even if that landscape is a shitstorm, right? You can see everything else that's showing up. And by giving yourself just that little bit of distance, you can see where to take your next step. And so I think that's kind of the difference between being caught up in all of these thoughts and feelings and memories to the point where you can't see anything else and having a little space from it to say, this tornado is showing up and it's consuming my life. And yet I can choose to take a step back from it. I can choose to just look around.
Do you find yourself speaking from that position or instructing the client to assume that position? It sounds to me like you more speak from that position. When you respond to your client, you speak from that diffused point of view.
That's a good catch.
And then you need to...
Oh, absolutely. So I there are very rare times when I tell people what they need to do. And normally it's in a serious conversation about like, what are we doing here? But most of the time, I'm a human being.
Sure.
And even if the things I'm, even with my tornado, looks different than your tornado. We both have tornadoes. Maybe my tornado is just a cute little, you know, dust storm swirling around, and yours is a huge vortex. But we both have tornadoes. And so I speak to the person as though I would want someone to speak to me, with the acknowledgement that we're all struggling with something. And I'm just hoping to share the framework of understanding and of looking at this stuff that I've developed for myself, and that ACT has proven through research to be helpful, so that they can take it on and move through their life. Like, I'll tell my clients, like, my greatest hope for them is that they never see me again. My greatest hope for them is that I can impart this, but I think almost as wisdom, I can impart this framework, this perspective, this lens for how they view the world, and that they can take that in, they can play around with it, come up with their own metaphors, their own way of thinking of it, apply it to their life, and then keep on living their life, hopefully in a more meaningful direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a great pro tip. I'm really struck, and I'm so glad that you caught that, Joanne. You know, in the moment, I'm like, oh, nice catch, right? But I don't think that should go understated, this position of, you know, the therapist as the companion, you know, the use of self, like in the room, speaking from the position with the client, rather than, you know, that hierarchical sort of like,
this will be helpful to you. It's
I'm the expert and my life is perfect. Though I will say,
and this is what you need to do.
Though I will say is that one of the mistakes clinicians can sometimes make while we're walking on this journey with our clients is forgetting that there is a power differential in the relationship. So even as I'm walking with this person, and even as I am self-disclosing for the purpose of helping them learn, I'm also have to stay aware of the fact that I do hold a position of power in the room, and be very careful not to take advantage of that in any way. I think sometimes in our hopes to not feel that we are this expert, you know, waggling our finger at someone, that we also forget that this is a position where we do have influence over another person, and we need to hold that within our consciousness as we are walking with this person, to do our best.
And the influence may not actually always be positive, because we are in a power position. Our clients may have much more of a pushback from us than they would. And this is another reason why I think group work is really powerful. You know, hearing it from a peer is way different than being told it by a therapist. And even if the therapist is speaking from their own experience.
Yeah. Right. And that's why it was really funny. I've worked in a lot of hospitals, and I've been a part of a lot of these groups. And oftentimes I come in as one piece of this group. And then there are, you know, wonderful nurses and lots of different specialists in different fields who are coming in and talking to folks. And I have to tread very carefully, because we will have a conversation about how information, facts, are not enough to cause change. And I remember I was taken aside by a nurse once and be careful with what you're saying. Like, you know, a lot of the people are giving them information. And it wasn't to undermine what the other professionals were saying, but it was to acknowledge we need to know the right steps to take. But there's more than just knowing the right steps to take. And the joke I'll make oftentimes with clients who are, you know, dealing with chronic medical conditions, particularly obesity, is like, you know how to lose weight. You could probably teach a class on weight loss. So your doctor sitting across from you and saying, you need to do this, and then you coming back and saying, like, that's not working, is not you being non-compliant or not you not getting it. It's just there's a piece that's missing. And I think that's a way that ACT can be really influential in the more kind of medical model, is that it can bolster this great information that like medical doctors already have, and bring an approach that acknowledges that it's not just about knowing what to do. It's about addressing all of the other messy stuff that makes the doing hard.
Jessica, have you ever seen, do you know who Kirk Strozahl is?
Yes, I love Kirk and
Patty. You seen his YouTube videos? There's actual videos of him doing just like 15-minute interventions with clients in a medical setting, you know, 15. Have you seen him, Tim?
I have.
Amazing. They're so amazing. He's so elegant. Mm-hmm. And he uses, you know, he starts the conversation speaking from the ACT stance. Mm-hmm. And eventually over time, you'll hear the client use the same language, that diffuse, talking about the problem, not me.
Absolutely.
It's so incredibly cool to watch.
So Kirk Strozahl and Patty Robinson, the founders of FACT, which is Focused Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, which is oftentimes used kind of in brief situations, have been a huge influence on my life and my career. Mm-hmm. There was a period of my life where I worked in a primary care mental health integration setting. Mm-hmm. So essentially, someone's coming in to a doctor's appointment, and maybe they mention to their doctor that they're feeling sad, or they're struggling with to make some changes in their life, or they're feeling anxious about something. And the doctor kind of walks them down the hallway and hands them off to me with the client's consent, usually, for a kind of brief conversation. So these are some folks who otherwise might not have gone to therapy, but could benefit from having a conversation. And yeah, it is wonderful to see how we can have these brief moments, right? We think of therapy as 50-minute sessions. You know, brief is 12 sessions, you know, it could go on for a long period of time. And yet this ACT as an approach can be built into just everyday conversations. Maybe we're just consulting with a colleague for 5 minutes in the hallway, and the language that we use can influence them. And doctors can use this to help bolster the change that they're trying to see in their clients, and facilitate that conversation instead of writing someone off as being kind of non-compliant.
So when you are working in those settings, I know you're doing ACT with the people who are walked down the hall with you, but my guess is you're also standing in ACT stance with your colleagues and responding from ACT stance to their conversation with you.
Yeah.
Can you just talk a little bit about being, you know, a guerrilla actor, you know?
Absolutely.
It's a weird concept, but, you know,
I've worked in a lot of interdisciplinary settings. So with, medical doctors, psychiatrists, physiotherapists, nurses, lots of different folks. And often we all have different tools in our toolbox, right? We all have different skills that we use to help clients. And the way that I really see my skill a lot of the time is to help facilitate shifting our perspective of how we view what the problem is. So a lot of times doctors get really frustrated. I used to work in a weight loss clinic, and doctors would get really frustrated. They talk with this person for months or years about the changes. The person comes in, they're really motivated. Yeah, I'm going to make this change. And they come back in a month from now, 6 months
from now, gained 20 pounds.
And nothing's changed, right? And this doctor who really cares a lot, and has used all the tools at their disposal, is not seeing this person change. And so the understandable conclusion that they make is that this person doesn't want to change. And so they stop putting more effort into them. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways that I think I help, because we would see a lot of the same clients in consulting with them, is talking about, well, what are some of the other factors that come up, right? What are some of the language that the clients use? Have you asked them what gets in the way? And if they say, oh, I don't know, or oh, I just stopped being motivated, can we dig a little deeper and really identify what's going on? So a lot of my work is framing eating habits or weight loss as a byproduct rather than the goal. So the byproduct of whatever is going on between the doctor and the client and between the client and their world, the byproduct is that they're not making these changes. but it's not the cause. The cause is there's something else that's going on. Mm-hmm. And even if that person does not have the skills to help that client identify what that is or work on it, I want to give them the skills, that doctor, the skills to recognize that that's what's going on and to refer them to me. They don't need to take on more tools and to be the therapist and the friend and the doctor and all of this kind of stuff. But I want them to have the perspective, that ability themselves to take a step back and say, what I'm doing isn't working. To assume immediately that it's because what I'm doing isn't working, not because this person is being obstinate or non-compliant or whatever. And pause to just have a real conversation about what's going on right now, and then help them seek other people who might be able to help them with that problem. And sometimes that's, I have a lot of things going on right now, and I don't think weight loss is a priority to me. And that's okay. I've had a lot of conversations with folks who, they're going through a divorce, or their kid's really sick, or they just lost their job, or something else is going on in their world. And this is important to them, but it's not a priority. And sometimes it's just having that conversation. But
it's like a values conflict.
Absolutely.
This matters to me, but there's other things that matter more.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then, and once we lay that out, it's no longer a conflict, because it's, well, I'm going to spend my time and attention on this thing that matters more to me, and then I'm going to come back to this later. And not that I give them permission, but we have a conversation that creates permission for them to do this. Yeah. That's not shaming, and that's not saying.
Or maybe it doesn't have to be all or nothing, It doesn't have to be on off. It could be, because I'm focused on my child's illness, I'm not going to have as much focus on this. I can put some focus, but not very much.
I'm just going to maintain. Yeah. Right? Yeah. I'm not going to try to do more things, but I'm just going to maintain. And it is a skill that medical doctors aren't often taught. And it's not their fault. I mean, they're like, the doctors I know really care about their clients, and they're trying and they're working so hard. But the problem is that sometimes the skills and strategies they have just aren't meeting what the issue is. And so I can help consult, help them create some shift in perspective so that they can recognize that, and then be able to connect that client, who's probably also feeling frustrated, to someone who is better equipped to handle it. So, like, for example, one of the things that comes up a lot with folks who are obese is a history of sexual trauma. Yeah. There are a lot of folks, women and men, who consciously or unconsciously, sometimes people will have a lot of insight into it, have almost with this idea of they sabotaged their attractiveness because it makes.
Oh yeah. Right. I've heard people say that. Absolutely. I totally gained the weight to keep them away from me.
Yeah. Yes. And so what happens is they'll kind of do this yo-yo thing where they'll be really motivated to lose weight because they know they want to be healthier or whatever their values are, but they start losing weight, and maybe people are saying really nice comments of like, oh, you look great. Maybe people aren't even saying anything, but they just feel more exposed. And immediately their reaction is, no, I can't, shut it down, abort. And they gain weight again. If a doctor is simply looking at the numbers, what they see is someone who's just yo-yo dieting, maybe not super committed, and they're so focused on the weight loss, understandably, we're in a weight loss clinic, that they don't recognize that there's something else that's going on here. And so a lot of times when I was in the weight loss clinic, I would focus on things that had nothing to do with weight, but that would help them get to a place where they could be the person that they wanted to be in terms of their health and the behaviors that they did. But first, we needed to bring out into the open this really significant trauma and how that's influenced their life. And when talking with folks, they'll say, the ironic thing is that actually putting on more weight puts me in a less safe position because I can't run away or fight or defend myself as well, than if I were, strong and fit.
Mm-hmm. So Before we start to wrap up, I want to contrast that with something, mm-hmm. because that's a great example. And I love the fit of ACT with behavioral medicine and connecting with allied health professionals. Have either of you had the experience where, whether it's allied health or even just other psychosocial professionals, whether it be, other mental health professionals.
I'm going to pause you right here because you have a lot of experience with this, of doing yes. ACT in a lot of different environments. So I'd really like to hear your thoughts rather than asking about ours.
Well, what I wanted to say is, have you had pushback?
Have you had pushback, Tim?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But yeah. I think, and I'm going to, you know, I think that this is a privilege thing. Like as a white guy who, is, and I don't mean to brag here, but, you know, who's articulate and who can be assertive and knows their position, I think I'm able to get away with a lot more than other colleagues of mine who might, you know, be interested in things that are a little bit different. Like I remember as a student, I was hired to work at a CBT clinic because I had challenged the CBT clinicians who were presenting, to our class about like, well, how do you measure success? Like, what are you even talking about? How do you know the stuff that you're doing is working, right? Mm-hmm. And they knew that I had an interest in ACT and had me actually give a presentation on ACT. Now, I don't think anybody left that presentation thinking, yeah, this acceptance position. In fact, one of the pieces of feedback that I got from one of my colleagues, somebody who I respected very deeply, was like, they literally had doubled over laughing. Their face was red. They were laughing so hard during this presentation that I was giving on ACT. And it was actually very heartbreaking for me. I was in tears afterwards. They didn't know this.
Yeah.
But I remember this colleague of mine saying this really, and you have to keep in mind, I was a student at the time working in this clinic, yeah. right? Like I hadn't, you know, written a book with Jessica that had won an award yet or any of this kind mm-hmm. of boss kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so she says to me, like, well, if we're helping people to accept their pain, like, what? Why would they hire us? Why would they come and pay us money to, you know, we have to be the expert. We have to get rid of what's wrong. We have to have all the answers. Mm-hmm. And that was hard for me. That was a tough pill for me to swallow.
Yeah. How did you respond?
I think at the time I had a very, I tried to kind of keep my cool. And my mm-hmm. response in the moment was something to the effect of maybe some of the issues that we treat, like maybe we just see different kinds of populations. Cause I work with a lot of people who have had a lot of experience fighting this stuff mm-hmm. and not winning. And mm-hmm. when they come in, they feel super validated. Like that's one of the things that I hear immediately from people is almost this sigh of relief where people say to me like, oh, he gets it, mm-hmm. you know? And I really tried to keep together. I have no need to try to appear like a tough machismo guy. I totally, you know, I cried afterwards, you know, yeah. on my car ride home, I felt really embarrassed and really silly.
Yeah. See, that's what I'm wondering about, you know, for maybe most of us who are ACT people is that we're willing to look stupid and silly. And have people go, what the hell are you talking about? Again and again and again and again, because there's something that yeah. matters more. I mean, I don't like looking silly. I don't like people making fun of me, you know?
Yeah.
But there, I mean, it just sounds to me like that's part of being an ACT person, therapist. It's just like, all right, here I am, you know?
It's a very interesting unifying theme in the work, I think.
Mm-hmm. Like I really hear it in Jessica's work, you know, and yeah, and definitely in Glenn's conversation, the earlier conversation we had with Glenn.
So
Glenn Callahan.
Maybe if I used this word, humility.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not about me.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And going back to your idea of working in an interdisciplinary setting. So for those who are watching the video might be able to see, but maybe not who are listening to the podcast, not only am I young, but I look very young. Yeah. I get carded on a regular basis and ask not to sit at bars and things like that. Like, that's how young I look. I'm not that young. Yes. But I've found that in working with medical doctors in particular, because they oftentimes deal with facts and numbers, and the medical model really focuses on, let's break a person down into a diagnosis and then let's fix that problem, mm-hmm. that I have had to show a lot of humility. And I have definitely had a lot of times I've gone home crying or gone into my office and been very frustrated crying, because they don't listen to what I have to say. And a lot of times when I'm in a setting that I know I'm going to be for a long time, it's a long game, right? And it's
a long game. That's a really good way of saying it. It's a long game. Yeah.
And I get it. Like, if you've been in a clinic for a long time and I come in and this, like, you know, this person, and they're like, oh, I know how to fix everything. And you know, if I were, you know, waving ACT around as if it was the cure all for everything, of course they're going to be dismissive of me.
I want to ask a little question here. Cause I think this is an important part in training. I know all you both have done trainings. Have you ever done like a demo or a role play or something, and your partner, the person you pulled from the audience, has decided to play Stump the Chump?
All the time.
Well, you know what I think it is that these are people, all of us, who are working as hard as we possibly can, and to have some, you know, some person come in and say, let me show you how you're doing it wrong and how you can do it better. I don't think any human being reacts very well to that.
Yeah.
But that Stump the Chump thing is, I think, something that happens a lot.
Yeah. My first stance is always, I'm just going to listen. I'm going to sit back and I'm going to listen, and I'm going to get a feel for the setting. I'm going to get a feel for the frustrations and the challenges that person's facing, because that gives me more information, not in like a manipulative way, but it gives me more information to know, well,
how big is their tornado?
Yeah, yes. Can I speak to the stuff that they're struggling with as helping professionals who are trying to help so much and are feeling stuck? Can I, rather than, let's say, can we help our clients, but can I help you learn a new way to think about all of this stuff so that then, like, your life is easier in helping some of these clients? And I've actually, we've had... I have had medical professionals in meetings try to play the stump the chump. Kind of, well, what about this situation? Or bring up this data. And I'm a very go with the flow kind of easy personality. But I do have a problem when, you know, folks do try to kind of throw the gauntlet down, is I want to pick that up, especially when it's something I believe in, like ACT. Mm-hmm. And I have had to work really hard to hold in that urge and to notice, well, why is this person so insistent on breaking down what I have to say?
Why am I so insistent in picking up the gauntlet?
Exactly, right? Mm-hmm. And it can feel really threatening when someone else comes in and is trying to change something, because maybe it feels like, well, I must be doing something wrong, or they're saying that I'm bringing harm to my clients, or I'm not doing a good enough job. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, clinicians who go to trainings and do that in role plays, some of it I think is they want to see, like, well, can he, like, I have really difficult clients. I'm going to pick my most difficult client, and can he work his way out of this mess that I've thrown down? Mm-hmm. Also something that's really vulnerable about learning something new.
In front of people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so there's this natural tendency to kind of reassert power, right? The reassert, like, I know what I'm doing and I'm helping people and you're not going to make me feel bad. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not aware that that's what they're doing.
Yeah. So this Tim, you said we need to start winding up. Is that?
Yeah, this has been such an enlightening conversation. Thank you both so much. You know, one of the main takeaways that I have from this is, I love, you know, it's so interesting because we early on, we started our conversation with this position of like clients realizing that they're not alone. Something this podcast is really giving me is the sense like, I'm not alone.
Right, exactly, right?
Because like I'm in my office. This is the place where I do, you know, my day job, right, of seeing clients, which I love. But it can feel very siloed off. And especially when I'm doing a therapy that seems like, well, I know it's cutting edge, but it seems like a little bit of a special interest kind of topic. Mm-hmm. And so to just be able to celebrate, commiserate, you know, with the two of you, this is really cool.
Yeah.
Do you want to have the last word, Joanne?
No.
How about you, Jessica? Any last words?
Let's give Jessica the last word.
I really appreciate both of you having me on here. I'm really excited about the podcast and to listen to all the other guests that you've had on. And I would just encourage everyone, whether you're in a helping profession or you're just fascinated by this stuff, to be open to it and to realize that it's not as convoluted and scary as a lot of people try to make it out to be. Mm-hmm. But it's simply about how can I hold the difficult stuff that shows up, mm-hmm. so that I can take more from life. Mm-hmm. And I hope that for everyone.
That's really cool.
That's a good ending. Thank you so much.
Jess, is there anything you want to plug before we say goodbye? Anything that you want us to put in the show notes?
Can we put our ACT deck in the show notes?
Yeah, we can put the ACT deck. It's 55 brief ACT practices. It's just, mm-hmm. it's a, I don't know if you've seen this, Joanne. It's a card deck.
Oh, and I have my, so I've been in the process of developing some kind of mini self-help books that are from an ACT framework. So I even have can I run
sure,
off?
Sure, of course, absolutely.
Of course.
I'm really impressed with both of you. What do we got?
So I have my Master Guide to Stress. So it's a very brief book. I have a thing against self-help books that are so long that no one's actually going to read them. Mm-hmm. But it's a kind of mini, straightforward, super practical self-help book. My just kind of helping to navigate stress and a lot of the things that we've been talking about, right? How to survive when our world is full of
tornadoes
and shitstorms. And my goal in this was really to try to provide some low cost resources to folks. So like if you're in on like Amazon, it's $2.99 for the ebook. So it's super accessible. But if you're interested in learning ACT and wanting to kind of apply some of these things for yourself, it can be really helpful. It's written in very, I don't want to say plain language, but just conversational language.
The way normal people talk, not in scientific jargon.
Exactly.
Therapist-y talk.
Yeah, you don't have to sit there with a dictionary and a highlighter.
It's like Catania. Yeah.
Like Catania, exactly. Yeah. Do you have a website or anything where people can come to see your work?
I am very bad at self-promotion, so I appreciate both of you asking these questions. Yes, I do have a website. It's yourpsychology.ca, because I am in Canada. And I have a blog on there, which I'm going to be kind of ramping up. Also, people who subscribe to my newsletter can get access to my resource library. So I have a bunch of meditations, worksheets. I'm going to be adding videos soon to that.
Cool. You are industrious.
Oh, yes. Tim and I keep each other in check with making sure we're not taking on more than we can handle.
That's cool. Well, thank you so much. And I'll, for our listeners, of course, if you're watching on YouTube, you can check the description, or if you're watching the video, we'll put it in the description. And if you're listening, we'll put it in the show notes for the podcast. But thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us today. This has been a really fun podcast. And thank you, Joanne.
Yes, it has. Really fun.
Cool.
All right. Thank you both.
Have a great day, you two. And thank you so much to our listeners. Make sure that you're subscribed so that you stay updated on the latest from the podcast.
Yes. All right, take care.
Take care, folks.